I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 14th of January. There is news today that Al-Qaeda's branch in Yemen claimed responsibility for the assault on Charlie Hebdo last week. The target, according to the New York Times reporting, was chosen by Al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri in keeping with the wishes of Osama bin Laden. This came from Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula video and also in a print statement. Our guest this hour wrote a very interesting piece on January 11 in the New York Times. He was reporting from Paris, although he is based in Rome. Jim Yardley is our guest, and his piece is Jihadism Born in a Paris Park and Fueled in the Prison Yard. Today's New York Times says the attacks appear to reflect what analysts have described as an evolution in Qaeda tactics and logistics. Heightened surveillance, operatives are trained and assigned general targets. Details are no longer micromanaged by the organization. We'll be focusing on the people who were involved in these terrorist attacks and what their backgrounds are, and happy to have Jim with us this hour. He became the Rome bureau chief for the New York Times in September 2013. He spent the previous 10 years in China, India, and Bangladesh. He followed the 3,400-mile path of the Yellow River to document the environmental damage wrought by rapid economic growth in China. He won the 2006 Pulitzer for international reporting for a series, Rule by Law, which documented the rough justice of the Chinese legal system. He's the author of several books, including Brave Dragons, examining the cultural differences and similarities between the U.S. and China through the unlikely prism of basketball. So he will be able to shed light on who these terrorists are and a history of terrorist groups in France, how these young Muslim men who were then still teenagers became known to French authorities after the police busted their group in 2005, how many became radicalized when they were in prison. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at @KDunnShow. Later in the hour, the managing editor of the Long War Journal. Their mission is to provide reporting and analysis of the global war on terror, and they have been keeping track of what's going on all over the world. So it should be a highly informative and very interesting hour. And Jim Yardley, thank you very much for being with us. Hello.
Hey, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you, Jim. So you were in Paris trying to piece together a story that, and you did a great job of it, that nobody knew very much about these young people and what their history was in prison. Was it hard for you to find all this information about them?
there's quite a lot of journalists here digging around, and so we benefited from just working hard and working fast, and we got some court documents, some colleagues and I did, and that was very useful. I mean, I think what's interesting about this case is that, I mean, there's a lot of things are interesting and a lot of things we really are still trying to figure out, and I don't think it'll happen quickly. But we have three militants here. We have the Kouachi brothers, Sharif and Saeed, who were the two who attacked Charlie Hebdo, the satirical magazine. And we have Amade Coulibaly, who took hostages and killed four people at a kosher supermarket. And so there's just a host of questions we're all looking at. First of all, how were they able to manage to do this in one of the great capitals of the world? How were they connected to one another? How were they connected to terror groups, if they were, around the world? As you said in your opening, Al-Qaeda in Yemen has claimed a connection, or basically claimed the attack on the magazine. They said the Kouachi brothers were trained by them, were funded by them, and that the target had inspiration, target had come from them. They were not connected to Amade Coulibaly, although he released a video connecting himself to the Islamic State, ISIS. So we just have a tremendous number of things going on. I mean, one of the things that I focused on initially is the sort of the background of particularly the Kouachi brothers. They were orphans They came to Paris at 18 or 19, I think, and then they eventually lived in an area around the park, Beauchamp. And there they kind of came under the sway of a very charismatic, sort of self-proclaimed Muslim imam who was only in his early 20s. And he sort of looped them in into a group of a blended of sort of wannabe jihadists. The U.S. war in Iraq was underway at the time, and it was in angering many Muslims around the world and in France as well. And they cooked up a scheme to send over French Muslims to fight in Iraq against the Americans, and actually some did go. Sharif Kouachi was going to go, and then the authorities had wiretaps running, and they before he and his friend left, he was arrested. So, you know, even a decade ago, the authorities knew who this guy was, knew who two of them were, and so that was a decade ago. And you know, in those days, I think he was 22. He was sort of a bumbler. And so it's been sort of remarkable for, I think, even the authorities to see this guy who 10 years ago, I don't know how seriously they took, and this sort of ruthless demonstration of terror that they put on here in Paris.
You write in your article that Beauchamp network produced some of Europe's most militant jihadists. Is that because of the imams who were in that area? Is it because of others they met when they were in prison at a later time? Or why that area producing so many?
I think it's a combination of factors. 10 years ago, as I live in Rome, so I don't live in Paris, but 10 years ago, that 19th arrondissement area was, as I understand it, heavily immigrant, had lots of young Muslims as well as immigrants, and I think it was poorer and a little bit tougher. I think it's gentrified a good bit since then, as I understand it, but in those days. The figurehead for these guys was a guy named Fayyid Ben Yetu, and he was not really an imam. He was sort of a self-proclaimed imam. And in fact, one of the mainstream mosques had kicked him out, and the other mosque where he was meeting people kind of kept him at arm's length. So this is not—he was not representative of the vast majority of Muslims in this area, but he was appealing to these young, sort of alienated kids, and he was very charismatic. And they fell under his sway. What was interesting, though, is he also became aligned with a guy named Boubacar al-Hakim. And Boubacar al-Hakim and his brother Redouan actually went to Iraq and fought. And Redouan was killed in Fallujah. And as I understand it from the documents, I think this is correct, that the United States soldiers found Redouan al-Hakim's identification in battle, and they kind of looked at themselves and they're like, why on earth are French citizens in Iraq fighting us? And so they notified the French authorities, or it's possible the French authorities were on it already, and the French authorities put a wiretap on the al-Hakim family, and that's sort of what led in 2005 to the bust of this pipeline. What's interesting is Boubacar al-Hakim, who went to jail for this and then got out, has emerged as a major figure now with the ISIS, with the Islamic State in Tunisia, and is claimed responsibility for killing, I believe, three politicians there. So this was a guy, and this is a guy also who, when he was fighting in Iraq, went on French radio and basically called on his buddies to come fight. And so, you know, it's sort of, I'm not sure there's one figure who did this. There was more like a combination of figures. There's also a guy, and I confess his name escapes me, but he was from the area, and French media has reported that he's become a very militant figure in Syria.
Mm. And
so
what,
I think it's just a combination of things.
In today's statement from Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula made mention again of Anwar al-Awlaki, saying that he made the arrangement with those who carried out the attack, that he threatens the West both in his life and after his martyrdom. Is there truth in that? Does he still inspire a number of these terrorists?
I believe so. Yeah, we ran a big story that my colleague Scott Shane wrote on Sunday, and it was quite good. And it talked about Alikawi as he was American. He went and joined Al-Qaeda in Yemen and became sort of their face. You know, he could speak English, so he did these videos, and I think he was the creator of Inspire, which is a magazine that is an Al-Qaeda magazine, which essentially lists preferred targets. And so, we're still sort of confirming some things. So, you know, but one of the things that we think happened is that one or both of the brothers met him before he died. Now, he was killed by a U.S. drone in 2011, and that sort of turned him into a martyr in the eyes of jihadists. So that's what they're talking about, the idea that, because you can still go on and see his videos and see things like that. And so the idea that he is still, it's from a public relations standpoint. We're still trying to figure out whether we've reported that he met with them, and then we were trying to figure out the details of all of that. And we're still, there's lots of conflicting information about when they went to Yemen and which ones went. Did they both go to just one? But, it's obvious that he had a potent appeal mm-hmm. to them.
Give us a little bit of historical perspective, as you indicate in your article. For decades, you write, France has endured Islamic terror threats and attacks from Iranian-inspired groups during the 80s, Algerian extremists in the 90s, cells linked to al-Qaeda before and after the September 11 attacks. A couple questions, if you'd like to amplify on those, and how successful France has been in being able to diminish those threats. Were they more successful in some decades than others?
I'm not an expert on every decade, but I think the feeling is that although there have been there's been problems each time, and nothing has been perfect, that the French are actually pretty good at this, and that they have sort of stanched off, I think, these various waves of terror. I mean, they go back even farther. But what is, I think, really troublesome to the authorities now is that sort of these were isolated waves, one rooted in different geopolitical issues. You know, one with the Iran-related thing had to do with the French support of the Iraq War, as I understand it. The Algerian issues had to do with France's long history, colonial history with Algeria, and also the Algerian civil war. Al-Qaeda before and after, sort of local cells, 9/11 is obviously related to that. But they were sort of differentiated. And as I understand it now, what they're worried about is we're seeing some sort of intermingling. I mean, the Kouachi brothers and Koulibaly, well, particularly one brother, Sharif and Koulibaly, were sent to jail, to prison in 2005, where they met a guy, Jamal Bagal. Well, Bagal had been pretty highly recognized jihadist who had been convicted of plotting in 2001 after bomb the U.S. embassy in Paris. So that's a previous wave of that would be disconnected to what has motivated our current terrorists. But yet he meets them in prison. And then later in 2010, Koulibaly is convicted, Bagal is convicted, and Sharif is implicated but not convicted in another plot in which they are trying to break out of prison Belkacem, who was a terrorist convicted in 1995 of bombing a subway station as part of the Algerian terror period. So we've suddenly got people from different decades linked together, and now we have Al-Qaeda and Yemen saying they're doing it on our behalf. So I think for authorities, this is pretty terrifying.
Yes. Everybody wonders, and tell me if you can explain this in some way, and if it would indicate that there's a certain strategy for lessening the appeal of terrorism. It's just hard to understand. You can understand people being alienated and poor and petty criminals. It's very hard to make a leap to these people going to Yemen and learning how to kill massive numbers of people and taking some kind of delight in doing that. Do authorities need to look at the roots of what would make somebody even think of doing that as a life's work and taking some joy in being a martyr to this cause. I just don't get it.
Well, I mean, yeah, no, I think few people in the West do get it. It seems completely irrational, but it's a different worldview, clearly. Mm-hmm. It's a, I mean, I can't, and to be really honest, it's very tricky to try to make sweeping generalities of this kind of thing because every case is different. But in the case of these guys, I mean, you clearly had childhoods that had major challenges. They were orphans. Apparently, they grew up in an orphanage, and their experience was not a bad one. But then they sort of went to Paris, and they were rootless and didn't have, opportunities were less so. They got hooked, and, you know, they were impressionable. They were naive. I mean, remember, this is just a very, very thin minority of the people of their age who are Muslim in France. I mean, you know, that's so it's, but they were the ones who were impressionable, who were vulnerable, who were sort of open to this. And I think that, you know, that as much as anything else has to do with looking for a sense of purpose, I guess, and they found it eventually. I don't think their radicalization happened overnight, but, you know, it happened over 10 years.
And do you have a sense, Jim, of how many of these cells exist in France and in other parts of Europe? Obviously, people are on edge and worried about this, but do authorities have a good sense of how many potential terrorists are there?
I don't know an exact number. In the past, they have certainly, you know, they have different. There was a network they broke up in southern France. There were others. I think what's also happened is that these little networks kind of existed, and then they sort of fall apart and come back together, and they get very individualized. And then they're also, I mean, I think like the major terror groups like Al-Qaeda in Yemen, they are they're part of their tactics now, and my colleague Rukmini Kalamaki wrote about this today, is to sort of inspire lone wolf attacks, if you will. Now this one they're claiming credit for planning and financing it, but given that it's the difficulty they now have in communicating with one another, they're sort of trying to just inspire lone wolves to some degree. So I think that is a big problem too, whether it's a terror cell per se. I mean, you could argue that, you know, this was a terror cell of two, the two brothers. I mean, and then their friend sort of on the side. The other big issue is, and you know, a lot of questions are being asked about why the French stopped tracking these guys, because they were tracking them as recently as about a year or so ago. But that coincides with the rise of ISIS and the Islamic State, which no one was predicting. And also France has some problems because it has 1,000 to 2,000 French citizens who've gone to fight jihad in Iraq or Syria, and many of them are coming back. So, you know, suddenly they have to check these people out and see if they're also, if they've come back radicalized, if they're also a threat to France itself. So I think the French intelligence authorities, you know, have manpower issues. I mean, the French economy, like the European economy, is in trouble. Governments have had to cut budgets. So there's, you know, I don't know how many people they can watch at the same time.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Jim. We have time for a few phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. He is based in Rome, Rome Bureau Chief of the New York Times. He's done reporting from Paris, and important reporting. The Times has really done, I think, excellent reporting on all that's been happening. His piece appeared January 11, Jihadism Born in a Paris Park and Fueled in a Prison Yard. Jim has been reporting from all over the world, from China and India, and he's in Rome now and will probably be doing a little more reporting from Paris because of the enormity of this story. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, where we have Jim's article, I believe, on our Facebook page, which is well worth a read. And we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Starting our calls with Dennis in Fitchburg. Hi, Dennis.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, you know, I think we can definitely see a lot of similarity with what happened in France, same as what happened in England with the 7/7 attacks, or what happened in the United States with 9/11. And, you know, often we come to realize that there are all of these things like Operation Northwoods and the false flag attacks and the fact that our government often organizes terror attacks to, you know, carry out agendas. So really we got to defund, you know, these parts of our government that are pulling off these terrorist attacks.
Who's pulling off it? I don't get what you're saying.
Well, a lot of times the terrorist attacks are organized by our own government to pull off agendas like wars in the Middle East and, you know, policies to take away people.
Well, let me reframe that question, because we're not really pulling off terrorist attacks. But people do wonder, the Americans' plans and engagement in a war on terror does include a lot of drone strikes. It includes a lot of military targeting of suspected ISIS targets or Al-Qaeda targets. Does that fuel terrorism? Is it a possibility, Jim, or not?
Well, certainly in many of the statements that put out, I think I read the Al-Qaeda and Yemen statement today, and I think it mentioned sort of indirectly people killed in U.S. military action. And in the case of Sharif Kolachi, you know, he wanted to go fight in Iraq because the U.S. was there. Now, that's slightly different from a drone attack against a targeted terrorist, but the U.S. military and intelligence operations overseas have clearly angered many Muslims in many countries.
We go to Rich in Rhinelander. Hi.
Hi. I hope this is on topic. Your screener seemed to believe it was. I'm in trouble with my religious body because I've been accused of being Islamophobic. And what I tried to explain to them is that there's a gay Holocaust going on in many Islamic countries. I'm a gay man. I'm interested in what happens to my brothers and sisters. The idea that young boys are apprehended and then detained and caged and psychologically and physically abused, flogged, and in some cases executed, extends beyond my range of liberal cultural sensitivities. And I'm so tired in the West of the idea that, well, these are just other cultures, and they're different than ours. I'm sorry, but people running a Jewish delicatessen in Paris who are simply selling gravlax and bagels or whatever, going about their day, who are then summarily executed by people who ally themselves with some complex state religious notion, I hope your guest can tell me, okay, Rich, calm down. It's really not all that bad. But in terms of certain cultural kinds of things, it's medieval. It's horrific.
Jim.
Rich, I'm not quite sure how to take that one, to be honest. Are you asking me if I really don't understand your question, to be honest?
Well, I guess he's getting to, you know, sort of this. It is a clash of ideas in many ways. You know, that is there a part of the Muslim faith? How large is it that really is anti-gay, that will kill people for being anti-gay? Is there some part of Western culture? I mean, how can you attack people who are cartoonists? There really does seem to be a clash of you know, people being evolved and some of these people not being very evolved for what they're doing here. Does this represent a larger majority of this faith? Are these just wayward, you know, lost kids who are involved in this, who take on this horrible ideology? What does it signify, the whole thing? Is it large?
We have to be really careful not to confuse Islam with radical jihadism. They're different things. I think also you could look across a range of religions and find a fairly depth of intolerance against gays.
Right.
However, yeah, I think I know some of the things that Rich is referring to. I mean, there have been some, you know, there's been some pretty terrible, there have been all sorts of stories. I'm not quite sure I've heard of the ones you're talking about, but I think the broader question, I mean, what's obviously turned this terror attack also into sort of an ideological discussion has to do with the fact that the people initially killed were cartoonists, and this was seen as an attack against freedom of expression, which is a great ideal of Western civilization, and as it should be. I think that in France, we are seeing now a very interesting debate, because the French now are, you know, cracking down and promising to toughen their laws. And many Muslims are saying, well, and they have laws against inflaming racism and inflaming certain types of defamation laws. So a very controversial Muslim comic, Dieudonné, and I apologize if my French is bad.
Sounded good to me.
detained today because of comments he made. And his argument is, what is the difference between me and this magazine? And I think it's caused a pretty, you know, because you there are limits to what you can say in France. It's not unlimited. I mean, the World War II legacy of the Holocaust has created, with very good reason, some inhibitions about what can be legally said on issues of anti-Semitic issues. So I think that, you know, France is having a big free speech debate, and that's part of it. Or is there, not only must free speech be defended because it's so central, but is it being, are the restraints that are in place being equally applied? At the same time, clearly what happened in this attack is just horrific. I mean, this was a terrible thing, and it is certainly, I will say this, it has certainly sparked a massive uprising and sense of national unity that I can see right now in Paris. I think there were 3 million, at least a million, but maybe as much as 3 million people who came to the Unity rally, and this morning they put the new edition of the magazine out, and it was literally sold out within minutes of the newsstands opening. This is a magazine that prior to the attack had a circulation of 60,000, and now they think they're going to sell 5 million copies. So I think for most people, that was an effort to show, you know, unity, a commitment to free speech. I think that's it.
Yeah, but also you're seeing huge demonstrations taking place in Germany, in Dresden, anti-Muslim demonstrations. I've heard some Jewish leaders in Paris in the last couple of days say that Jews may want to consider whether or not they want to live in France anymore, that the optimists went to Auschwitz and the pessimists went to New York. I mean, I'm wondering how much of that, and you've got a very conservative, far-right, it's been called, party in France that seems to be attracting a lot of attention.
Yeah, no, one of the big stories in Europe, I wrote a huge story on anti-Semitism a few months ago.
Oh, you did?
I wrote a giant story. I went all over Europe. Reported the depth of it, because it's a real problem, and that part of it is that the sort of the dynamics of the Middle East are being transferred onto Europe. Part of it is not Middle Eastern, it's just sort of an endemic anti-Semitism that predates it, and it's sort of more of the type that was rooted in the Holocaust. You also have massive Islamophobia here. You have huge groups of Muslims that have been coming for decades, and they face regular discrimination as well. And then, so we have Jews who are seeing increasing discrimination and fear. We have Muslims who see regular discrimination and fear. We also have a continent that's in a terrible economic recession, where youth unemployment is in countries like Italy, where I live, it's at 40%.
Goodness.
So it's not a good recipe. You have a lack of opportunity. You have resentments boiling that are far-right parties. They're focusing on the influx of immigrants and things like that. So, I mean, it's a tenuous moment, and things like this just add to it.
Mm-hmm. Let us know when that article on anti-Semitism appeared. We'd like to put that on our Facebook page, and I missed it somehow. I'll have to read it.
Just look on our website. You'll find that it was massively long.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much, Jim, for your reporting.
No, I enjoyed
Thank you.
Your time.
Thanks. Thanks for being with us. Jim Yardley is the Rome Bureau Chief for the New York Times, and he has worked for the Times in China and India and Pakistan and many other parts of the world, and is a Pulitzer Prize winner. His piece was very interesting. He had to work pretty quickly to get this to print to figure out the backgrounds of the terrorists who killed the members of the news magazine and the cartoon magazine, all of those deaths, and also those who were killed in the Jewish delicatessen. His piece is Jihadism Born in a Paris Park and Fueled in the Prison Yard. We're going to continue our conversation with Bill Roggio, joining us momentarily, managing editor of the Long War Journal. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Bill Roggio joins us now, managing editor of the Long War Journal, senior fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, Hoover Institute media fellow, and a contributor to the Weekly Standard. His coverage includes wars in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Somalia, Lebanon, and Iraq, as well as al-Qaeda's operations, tactics, and strategies. He has embedded with the U.S. Marine Corps, the U.S. Army, and he served as a signalman and infantryman in the U.S. Army and the New Jersey National Guard from 1991 to 1997, and we will continue to take phone calls on our issue this hour at 800-486-8655. Hi, Bill. Thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for having me.
You cover this so carefully. Give us more information about what you've written about jihadists continuing to advertise training camps in Iraq and Syria. What are they doing?
Yeah, and we've documented at least 70 camps. Most of them are believed to be active. These are camps that are run by the Islamic State, by al-Qaeda's branch in Syria, which is known as the al-Nusra Front, and then a host of smaller jihadist groups that are aligned mostly with the al-Nusra Front, but some of them with the Islamic State as well. These camps are used to train individuals to wage their insurgency against the Syrian regime, primarily. But what we know about training camps from the way al-Qaeda has used training camps historically is that they siphoned off a small number of their recruits. They carefully select them to conduct attacks outside of the theater of operations. So you have to, part of the problem when looking at these terrorist groups is that we consider them to be just terrorist groups, that all they want to do is conduct an attack against the United States or France or wherever it may be. But we have to look at what their real goal is, and their stated goal is to establish a global caliphate and impose Sharia or Islamic law. And conducting attacks against the West is merely a tactic to achieve that goal. So they seek to take control of individual states. They fight local insurgencies. In the case in Iraq and Syria, they're fighting the Syrian regime and the Iraqi government. And they, again, you know, historically al-Qaeda and jihadist groups have taken individuals from these camps and conduct attacks outside. So it's just a bigger threat that they're training them for their local insurgencies, because nobody wants to see al-Qaeda in control of Syria or the Islamic State in control of Iraq, and that's just as a big a threat as them conducting attacks here against the West.
So,
it's more of a long-term threat.
So you don't see a stated difference between the mission of ISIS and the mission of al-Qaeda in Syria or Yemen?
No, absolutely not. Both goals, ultimate goals, is to establish an Islamic caliphate. I mean, the Islamic State parted with, or al-Qaeda actually ejected the Islamic State because of a leadership dispute. And then the Islamic State ultimately declared a caliph in Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, his name is Khalif Ibrahim, and they wanted, you know, and then they're trying to build their individual Islamic states. They're in competition with al-Qaeda, that's all. They want the same goals, but they just have different, there's leadership dispute with it between the two groups, but they want to do the same thing.
And tell me, what tactics has the West been using, and if any of them are successful, please tell us what those are, to keep people from going to these training camps?
The West has been attempting to detain individuals or deter them from traveling overseas, but that's easier said than done, because thousands of Westerners are thought to have attended or have fought in the theater, and it's unknown how many of these have gone through to camps. And the reason why they're particularly attractive is because these are individuals that possess Western passports that could more easily travel to and from their camps, wherever they may be, in Iraq or Syria, to the Western countries. And this is a threat that is going to exist for years, because there's the jihad in Iraq and in Syria, they're not abating. It's just getting worse, and it's attracting more and more recruits. And individuals aren't booking a ticket to Damascus or Baghdad. They'll typically go to places, you know, they'll travel to Turkey for whatever reason and then slip across the border and then, you know, wage jihad, go through a camp, and then try and slip back across into their home countries. That's what Western intelligence agencies fear. And rightfully so.
And why do you think they're attracting more recruits?
Because of their success. The Islamic State and al-Qaeda both control significant amounts of territory in Iraq and in Syria. And, you know, their messaging online is very attractive as well. So, you know, they have this sort of, just like, you know, the communists portrayed, you know, the that rebel or that revolutionary, the same type of mentality exists within Islam, where, you know, we're the radical branch of Islam, obviously, where they're saying, hey, you know, you need to fight jihad. That's part of being a true Muslim, is to wage jihad. And then they're spreading this message where our youth hang out during these days, which is on the internet. And the Islamic State is extremely effective at this, but al-Qaeda, particularly the al-Nusra Front and other jihadist groups, have been very effective at doing this as well. Not quite as effective as the Islamic State, but they're not far behind.
How many airstrikes have we conducted against training facilities?
I don't have the exact number. The U.S. has launched over 1,400 airstrikes in Iraq and Syria. I don't have the exact number that were launched against training facilities, but I would guess somewhere around 20 or 30 based on our tally. Some of these are follow-up strikes. So we believe that this is how we've actually identified the locations of some of these camps, is because CENTCOM announces that they're targeting the training camps. Other ways we've identified these camps is by the jihadist's own propaganda. So they're advertising these camps as part of their propaganda campaign to get Muslims to join up and wage jihad.
Mm-hmm. Do we need more of them, in your opinion?
More airstrikes?
Yes.
I don't think it's sufficient. It can keep them, it can harm them, but it's not enough to stop them. Unfortunately, this counterterrorism approach that the administration has relied on has not resolved the problem. I'm not going to say it's exacerbated it, but the reality is that jihadism has grown in the 6 years that President Obama has been president, and they've expanded their territory that is under their control in counterterrorism operations. And President Obama said, you know, that Somalia and Yemen were wild successes in counterterrorism operations, and we're going to do this in Iraq as well. Well, you just had the terrorist attack in Paris emanate from al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which is based in Yemen. So if that's success, I really hate to see what failure looks like.
So what do you think our strategy should be?
Well, I think before we even decide to do anything, I assume you're asking what is our military, should our military strategy be?
Any strategy. Anything.
Yeah, well, first we need to really sit down as a nation, and 13 years after 9/11, and actually define the nature of the threat. Until we decide what the nature of the enemy is, not just this individuals within a terrorist group, and if we just knock off a couple of leaders. Remember, President Bush had a list that he, you know, when he X'd people off the list and claimed, well, we've killed 75% of Al-Qaeda, the group's almost defeated. That was in 2003, 2004.
Yes.
You know, here we are a decade later. It doesn't work that way. Al-Qaeda isn't the way we wanted to define it. The administration has wanted to define it as this small cellular group that we could just knock off individuals. But we have to recognize that this is a movement that is where various groups are allied. It has a powerful ideology, and it appeals to a certain, when I say significant, segment of the Muslim population, whether that's 2%, 5%, 8%, it's enough to drive these radical insurgencies that are taking place and that are fueling terrorist attacks in the West as well. And so until we define the nature of the threat and can honestly look at this problem, we can't even begin to discuss strategy. This is the problem that we have. We refuse to properly recognize the nature of the enemy that we're fighting.
Bill Roggio is our guest, managing editor of the Long War Journal. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Anita in Lindenhurst, hi.
Hi. I actually have two comments. One is very short, and it refers to the comment the previous guest made, and that was that, you know, we have to be very careful not to, you know, define Islam and jihadists as the same. But I just want to say, as an American and as a person who is not a Muslim, that it makes it very hard on even us liberals to do that when we do not see the non-jihadist Muslims protesting. That would go a long way. The other thing is, I think what your guest just now said was just profound. We really do not know this enemy. It's like watching Criminal Minds on television and then seeing that these people think in a crazy, bizarre way, and they're brilliant. And yet here we are trying to plan things, you know, by our own, we're not being objective. Everything that we strategize is subjective by our own ethics and our own frame of mind and what the knowledge that we have, rather than trying to get inside their culture and their very angry political minds. That's all I have to say.
Thank you for the call.
Yeah, thank you for the kind words. You're absolutely right. We're trying to define the enemy as we want them to be, not as the way they are. So, you know, for instance, the Obama administration is particularly guilty of this, of claiming, well, it's just insane to say that they want to establish a global caliphate. That's fanciful. But when you watch it, how they're operating, how they're waging local insurgencies, the messaging that they put out, how they talk to communicate with each other, how they trade operatives across theaters, it's very clear that that's how they're operating. And until we recognize that, we can't develop a strategy to fight that. And as far as to your first point, I do understand the frustration with a lot of Americans have with that. And I'm going to give you my perspective from someone who's embedded actually with Muslims, with Muslim militaries. From 2005 to 2008, I used to go to Iraq and embed with the military training teams. These were like 8-man, 12-man teams that would embed with about 700 Iraqi soldiers or police units or whatnot. And what I saw was Muslims actively going out and risking their lives to fight an enemy that they hated. And so it's really difficult knowing that there are Muslims who just abhor what Al-Qaeda and what the Islamic State represent and whatnot. And yet I don't think the American public really understands that there's a significant population in the Muslim world that is actually actively fighting against them, and it's frightening. And I don't think we have done the right things to back these groups. I mean, with the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq, look, I understand that a lot of people wanted to get out of Iraq, and President Obama fulfilled his campaign pledge, and that's, you know, that's commendable in a way, except by doing that, we left a large group of Iraqis who we promised to support, the awakening groups. They were actively fighting Al-Qaeda. I watched them do this with my own eyes, watch them risk their lives. And when they were captured, they were summarily executed by the enemy. And we abandoned them. And now they're the people that are being overrun in Iraq today.
Well, you have to reach a point, though, where those people have to fight for themselves, don't they?
I agree, except they weren't prepared to fight for themselves. We're trying to fight. The Taliban have a saying. America has all, or the West has all of the clocks, and they have all the times, all the time. What they're saying is, we have all the fancy tools. We have, you know, fighter planes and drones and what you name it. But they'll just wait us out. So we want to fight these wars on our election cycles. If we're going to engage against this enemy, we have to be prepared to fight in for the long haul. If not, then if we're not prepared to do that, we're going to have to be prepared to watch countries fall under their control. That's what's happening today.
We'll take more phone calls for Bill in a moment. Bill Roggio is our guest, managing editor of the Long War Journal. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And our email is talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go back to phone calls. Richard is next in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Richard.
Hello. If you start with the Iraq War, that was a war of choice based upon massive government lying. It killed hundreds of thousands of people, drove a couple of million people into exile, and now we spend our time posturing about these terrorist events by very angry people whose hatred we created. And seem to be surprised about it. Oh, how awful they are. We never consider how awful we are. And I just don't understand, but I think one of the reasons I don't understand is because nobody has really defined what terrorism is. If it is the violent political killing of innocents, then nobody has more blood on their hands than do we. And until we recognize that, we will never solve this problem at all.
Bill.
Well, then I guess you assume that the attack on the 9/11 was justified then. Running airplanes into buildings was justified? Is that what you're telling me?
With the attack on 9/11.
That did occur before the Iraq War was won. Am I correct?
And Arabians. By the way,
Excuse me, I mean, 9/11 did happen prior to the U.S. launch in the Iraq War. Is that right?
His comment, though, is that our response going into the country under false pretenses created a whole lot of anger.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, the New York Times just ran a long expose on how chemical weapons were found all over Iraq, but I'm not certain about that. I mean, we can... You know, look, that wasn't published at a right-wing media outlet. That was the New York Times, and you could choose to believe the article at the New York Times or not, but there were indeed chemical weapons found within Iraq. So I would argue that it's not false pretenses regardless. Iraq was in violation of multiple United Nations resolutions. Look, we could fight the debate over the Iraq War, but we're fighting an enemy that seeks to impose a global Islamic caliphate. And whether we entered Iraq or not, 9/11 happened, and I don't know what people expected the U.S. response to be. Would it be just sit around a campfire and sing kumbaya, or do we have a right to defend ourselves when under attack?
Let's go to Ken. Thank you for your call. Ken and Eau Claire, we have about a minute.
Thanks, Bill, for your knowledge. I would like to know what your thoughts are on the Al Jazeera networks here that are broadcast here in the U.S., there were some interdepartmental memos that were leaked out this weekend where they purposely were downplaying the event that happened in Paris.
We have about 30 seconds, Bill.
Yeah, you know, look, I'm someone who's appeared on Al Jazeera, so I'm somewhat mixed on the news organization. They certainly, like all news organizations, have biases. I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, one of the things I always say about reading Al Jazeera's web edition is if it's not about Israel, it's usually the coverage is pretty good. But they certainly have their biases, and I wouldn't be surprised to hear that given some of the things that Al Jazeera has done over the past.
Thank you, Ken, for the call. Bill, thanks for your time today.
You're welcome. thanks very much, Kathleen.
Yeah, our pleasure. Bill Roggio, managing editor of the Long War Journal. And just a reminder, tomorrow at this time we'll be looking at the horrors in Nigeria, which has not been front and center, and we will make it so tomorrow during this time period. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Thanks for all of your calls. I'm sorry we didn't get to all of you. Leave your messages on Facebook. You can continue the conversation there, and that is The Kathleen Dunn Show.